Hi, my name's Martin Purnell, and welcome to our weekly Off-Grid Christianity podcast, a programme for people who feel disconnected from church. On today's podcast, Cherie Green joins me to discuss her life to date and why a few years ago, when many would be thinking about early retirement, she decides to leave one law firm and set up her own, specialising in helping those where mental health is a key issue. Her firm has now won two major awards as a result. And by the way, after today's podcast, if you wish to contact us about any of the things you've heard today, our email address is OGC. That's OGC. Funny enough, stands for Off-Grid Christianity. How bizarre that is. At accessradio.biz. At accessradio.biz. And biz is spelled B-I-Z. Cherie, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. A quick question before we go on to the main thing. What's the difference between, and it's not a trick question, what's the difference, please? Sounds like a joke, doesn't it? What's the difference, please, between a lawyer and a solicitor?
Oh, that's very clever, Martin. Well, a lawyer is a generic term for people who practice within the law. And so solicitors and barristers are two different sorts of lawyers. That's it, basically.
Yeah, one's a solicitor, the other one's a coffee maker, isn't it? A barrister.
Something like that, yes.
Yeah. One day that'll get laughed, but... Right, then, as you know, because you've obviously listened before, we have five, maybe not so simple questions, or maybe they are, so we can get a better understanding of who Cherie Green really is. So, fingers on the buzzers, no conferring, please. Question number one. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
Okay, so I have chosen for my mystery guest, Barbara Castle.
The Barbara Castle from the 70s?
The Barbara Castle from the 10s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s. Yes,
wow.
I've chosen, for those who may be of an international connection. So Barbara was a member of parliament and she served as a minister in Harold Wilson's government, as you said, Martin, in the 70s. I mean, she came actually from Chesterfield, so she was sort of a northern lass.
Oh, right, okay.
She lived in Bradford, and eventually she was appointed MP for Blackburn in 1945. And interestingly, she only got her place on the candidacy because the Labour women of Blackburn said that they would quit unless she was added to the all-male shortlist. So she was appointed MP, and the first thing she did was to actually move in with the Blackburn family.
Oh, really?
Because although she'd lived in Bradford and Pontefract, she'd never lived in Blackburn. So she moved in with a local family to find out what the pressures were in their lives, and she actually learned spinning and weaving, which was a big industry at the time. So, you know, she really got her sleeves rolled up. But I think people remember her perhaps for her work on the Equal Pay Act in 1970, where women and men were granted equal pay for doing the same type of work for the first time. And they've made it into a film called Made in Dagenham. It's a really good British film. But before that, she was a friend of Nelson Mandela in the 50s.
Oh, really?
Years before he, you know, was arrested into Robben Island. She was an apartheid campaigner. She was Minister for Overseas Development. Mm-hmm. In fact, she set up the Ministry for Overseas Development, and she introduced interest-free loans for poorer nations. And then she was given a very boring job, it seemed, as Minister of Transport. But the first thing she did was to introduce the breathalyzer. And interestingly, she was on the BBC. The programme was The World This Weekend.
Yeah.
And the BBC interviewer actually said to her, "You're only a woman. You don't drive. What do you know about it?" But deaths plummeted after the road fatalities plummeted. And then she followed that up with compulsory speed restrictions and then the seatbelt, which saves now a couple of thousand lives a year.
And my late father, by the way, just saying.
Really?
Yeah. Really? He was driving, for those of a certain age, you might remember a Triumph Herald car.
Okay.
And he was driving along and this car came straight down the hill, smacked into my dad. My dad did three somersaults in the car, upside down. I was six at the time, and I came back from school. These were the days in primary school when you could come back from school at lunchtime to have lunch and go back. And I was called back early. I was really annoyed with my mum because I wasn't able to play football. You know, this is a major travesty in my life. Yes. 6 years of age.
Yes.
Can't
yes.
play football. I have to go home. I remember my dad walking in, you know, and he was like, white as a sheet. And I thought, is that it? But yeah, so seatbelt saved my dad's
life. Wow. Yeah. And many children from being orphaned and many spouses from being widowed, you know. So, I mean, she was a gutsy lady. But, you know, there's no evidence she had any Christian faith or any faith at all. So it'd be interesting to understand what drove her.
Yeah.
You know, what caused her to see the need and to follow through and deliver, you know, real outcomes for genuine issues. So, yeah, it'd be Barbara Castle coming to my dinner. I'd be a bit scared of her, to be honest. I'll be a bit scared of her, but she'd be fascinating to speak to.
Yeah, well, if she does, ask me, you know, what she really thought of Harold Wilson, would you?
Yes.
Let me know.
Yes, I'll let you know.
Thank you. Question number two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable?
Okay, this is Mary Magdalene is my favourite biblical character, much misunderstood. I mean, if you go through the Gospels, what do we know about her? Well, she was a lady of wealth because she covered Jesus' needs and the disciples' needs from her own wealth. We know that she had demons cast out of her. We know that she was there at the cross when Jesus was crucified with Jesus' mother. We know that she was there at the tomb when Joseph of Arimathea offered the tomb for Jesus. And we know that she was there in the dark the first morning to try to anoint his body. And amazingly and graciously, we know that Jesus appeared to her the first person and that she touched him. And he said, don't cling to me, Mary, but go and tell, you know, the brothers. And so she is called the apostle to the apostles. Much misunderstood. She's often conflated with the Mary who broke the alabaster bottle of perfume on Jesus. Not that Mary. Pope Gregory decided that she was the woman of ill repute. There's no evidence for that in the Bible.
Now, I was going to sort of throw that in because there's a great program that's available now on YouTube called Jesus' First Female Disciples. It was originally shown on Channel 4 about 10, 12 years ago.
Okay.
Absolutely fan-blinking-tastic, that programme. So, yes, they talk about that as well.
And I just love the relationship that she had with Jesus, you know. I mean, it was the complete relationship, wasn't it? You know, it wasn't a romantic relationship. You couldn't have a deeper love. And I just think how brave she was, you know, when the disciples, you know, actually, for all kinds of reasons, were frightened and dissipated. You know, she was there, faithful, faithfulness to her Lord. Such a shining example, such a challenge, such a wonderful woman.
Well, if my wife was listening, she would go, yes, because I think that's who she would choose as well.
Oh, brilliant. I'm in good company there.
Oh, you'd be in good company there indeed. Yeah. And in fact, also, it sounds as if I'm giving adverts out here, but if you watch the Chosen TV series that's available on the internet and things like that on their own podcast, they do a fantastic thing about Mary Magdalene. You know, she's interwoven into a lot of episodes. Question three. Good choices so far. if I'm laughing because I think you could do a great job as a prime minister, not just for a day, actually.
Bless you.
If you were prime minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
Okay, this is an easy one for me. So as you mentioned at the beginning, my work is with people who have mental health issues or who have learning disabilities. And there's a scandal in our nation that's been going on. It was uncovered around 10 years ago, but it's been continuing. And that is that we don't have services in our community to meet the needs of many people, mm-hmm. particularly people with learning disabilities and autism, who may sometimes show some challenging behaviour. And very often the families, who dearly love their child or their sibling in this situation, sometimes the lack of services puts such great strain on the family that they come to the end of the tether, really, and they need help. Because there is so little help, what's often suggested is that the person goes into a hospital, for things to settle down, etc. And if you have autism and learning disabilities, a hospital is the worst possible environment yeah. for you. You know, it's bright lights, it's uncertainty, it's unpredictability, it's constant changeover of people. And what happens then is this person often becomes more traumatised, and the behaviour that they show becomes perhaps more extreme, more challenging. Maybe they lash out, they become restrained, they get secluded. And then it's suggested, this hospital isn't secure enough for them. Maybe rather than going home, they need to go to a more secure hospital with greater restrictions. And at the moment, there's about 2,000 people in England and Wales in this situation, stuck sometimes for years in these hospitals. I acted for a man who'd gone into one of these hospitals at 19, and he was in his 40s. When he actually left and got back into the community. So my law would be that there would be mandatory funded community services, so that when people need help, the help is there, and they're not sent hundreds of miles away to an institution where, their life becomes more and more difficult and the traumas they experience are just increased. So it'll be mandatory services. In fact, there is a mental health bill going through Parliament, and, one of the aims is to prevent this happening. But at the end of the day, sadly, it's about yeah. money. And if the funding isn't there, the services won't follow. So that's my law for my Prime Minister Day.
Excellent. And can I just say that no doubt you'll be talking about that later in the programme as well, when we talk about what you do. Coincidentally, when you were saying that, it reminds me of Blue Peter, that TV programme that we all used to watch as kids, and kids most probably still do now. And in the late 60s, early 70s, it really affected me because they followed a chap called Joey. Do you remember that?
I don't. Tell me more.
It was the first time we ever knew anything about this as a kid myself. And like you said about these people who he obviously had learning difficulties. But from what I can remember about him, he was like in a dormitory all his life. And it was only later on in life that he was able to be released. And that's all I can remember about him. But that's the first thing. And the second thing also, I hardly ever cry. That's one of my things. I can't cry. Unless a certain football team of mine loses, which has happened a couple of times. I remember watching my girlfriend at the time. It turns out it was a TV movie starring Mickey Rooney in his later years of life. Because I think Mickey Rooney's still alive, isn't he? I think.
I don't know.
And he plays his character as someone also who has mental health issues. And is always, I don't know whether the technical term is, he's now backward.
Learning disabled,
very badly learning disabled, and it's how a family decide to foster him, even though he's like in his 50s and 60s. And at the very end, by his attitude and everything else, he meets the then President of the United States, and I absolutely wet buckets. But you see, that was like 30 years ago when I saw that film, and we haven't really changed a lot, have we?
Some things have changed, but there's a report out at the moment which, if you're a woman but you have a learning disability, then your life expectancy is 26 years lower
really
than for a woman without a learning disability. So many things have changed. Well, it may be in part that some people who have a learning disability have maybe an underlying other medical conditions, perhaps. But I think it's well recognised that people with learning disabilities don't get the same quality of medical treatment. They don't get the same level of care. And therefore, you know, when a diagnosis is picked up late, the treatment may not be as rigorous. I mean, you may remember through COVID, many, many people with learning disabilities had DNRs placed on their records, do not resuscitate. Mm. And they were done in many ways as a blanket measure, whereas it should be done by consultation with the person. You know, what do they want? What do they feel with family? What's in the, you know, what's going to be best for the person? But, you know, no, they were, you know, MenCap have discovered they were placed on people's records in a blanket way. So many premature deaths, unnecessary, avoidable premature deaths. So, yeah, we've got a way to go for equality.
Yes, definitely. And no doubt we'll come back to that later on. Wow, we're only on question three.
Sorry.
No, it's brilliant. It's fantastic. Question four, outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
Well, recently I was very happy to be invited along with my sister and two of her friends to go wild swimming.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
Tell us more.
Well, I mean, for those who are not familiar, I mean, it's basically not swimming in a swimming pool or a marine, it's swimming in a lake or a river. So we went to a beautiful lake in Whitchurch, and goodness me, was that water cold.
Whitchurch is in Shropshire, isn't it?
Whitchurch, Shropshire,
yeah,
England.
There's quite a few Whitchurches around. There's one in Bristol. I wouldn't recommend.
Oh, is there?
Oh, yeah,
okay,
big, Oh, big place, Whitchurch, massive sports centre. And just to be show a piece of useful information for those that want to know. There was only one airport opened in the whole of the UK in the Second World War that was granted special status as a civil airport.
What?
So the Germans and everybody else knew that was a civil aviation aerodrome and they couldn't bomb it. And that was Whitchurch Airport. There you go. Thank you.
And that was Whitchurch Bristol, was it?
Whitchurch Bristol. Yep.
Whitchurch Bristol. Okay.
Piece of useless information, but true.
Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, so I had a glorious, I mean, it was cold. And when I got out, I don't know if you've ever seen those sea lions on Pier 39 in San Francisco.
Oh.
You see them in all the... Yes, I was literally like a beached sea lion when I got out. I was exhausted and could hardly move, and I was frozen. But it's like a kickstart. You know, sometimes you hear a sermon or a talk and it's a kickstart spiritually. This was like a physical kickstart, and yes, it was a joy to be out in nature.
Well, I'm glad you found it a joy. I wouldn't have done. Not one bit. But that's great stuff. And finally, question five. What has been your most embarrassing moment to date?
Well, I'm a very clumsy person. And so most of my embarrassing moments involve me falling over things. The two particular I remember were involved in a tribunal. So I represent people who are detained under the Mental Health Act. Mm-hmm. And they used to have a court hearing effectively in a room. Now they're all on video. But you would all sit around the room and it's very serious. It's a court hearing. And there was one occasion when I was going through the menopause and I'm very, very pale. I'm a pale person. And I sat there and I was about to start my cross-examination and I could feel the heat starting from my feet going up my body, and I knew that my face was turning crimson, and I could see it in the eyes of the panel members, you know.
Yeah.
Their eyes were on saucers as this woman changing color like a chameleon in front of them. But what do you do? You just get on with it. My other tribunal embarrassing moment was when I sat through a lengthy hearing with my legs crossed, got up, stood up and promptly fell over onto the tribunal, onto the panel. And the doctor got up, oh, are you all right, Mrs. Green? Are you, you know, but I mean, you know, very embarrassing.
Well, I think the second, we'll go with the second one. I think the first one, although I know very little about the menopause for some obvious reason, yeah, we'll go for the second one. Yeah, thank you very much indeed.
We've got to educate the men though, Martin, you say. We've got to educate
the
men.
Well, you've got another 40 minutes in which to do that. So let's go back in time then and build up, because I get a feeling that before you went into the law business and everything else like that, you obviously had gone to university. What did you study at university?
I studied chemistry at university.
Why?
Because I was good at chemistry, and that's kind of how it worked, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
well,
I think if
used
I had
to.
Not, Used to work. And so after I graduated, I trained to be a teacher. And so I was a chemistry and physics teacher for a while.
And where was that?
It was in Antigua in the Caribbean for a couple of years to start with. I was the head of science in a very small secondary school in the centre of the island.
Wow.
It was difficult. It was hard. For those who know their science, we didn't have distilled water and things like that. You know, the water came up from a well, and for the experiments, it was tricky. There's no glass in the windows. The breeze just came through and the rain.
Wow. But any Bunsen burners?
We did have Bunsen burners, actually, and huge stocks of sodium. I don't know if you know much about sodium.
No.
But if you, sodium's a very, very reactive group one metal. And if you take a little bit of sodium and you put it onto some water, it fizzes and burns and, you know, it's quite explosive. And we had jars of the stuff in a cupboard. I've no idea why, but yeah. So I taught for, and then I came back to the UK, by which time I decided it was right to retrain in law.
Well, yeah, what made you change your mind from obviously going over to Antigua, enjoying the sunshine, watching the cricket in the afternoon when you finished school, obviously. Or maybe not.
No, I did. I saw Vivian Richards score a century. I did, in St John's.
Wow.
That's the main cricket ground. I did.
Fantastic. So, but then you wanted to give that all up and you came back to England. But why change?
Well, I grew as a person living overseas. Mm-hmm. I grew in my faith, you know, living on my own. No mobile phones then, of course. I had a short band radio. So all I could listen to was the World Service.
The Archers.
TVs. Did we get the Archers on World Service? I can't remember,
did,
actually. I can't remember.
I've never listened to a whole episode. So.
Well, there you go. And I kind of felt that I'd fulfilled what I was meant to do as a teacher. And it would be very strange to come back from that very challenging environment into mainstream education. So I did a very sensible thing, and I wrote a list of what I was good at and what I was not good at, what I liked in the world of work and what I didn't like. And then in my very rational way, I tried to work out from that what would be a good fit for me. And the conclusion was the law. I did pray about it as well and asked friends to pray about it. Yeah. But it was a very logical decision, that's all.
Do you know, you explaining that, I don't know if you know, but I used to be a training officer many, many, many moons ago before going into broadcasting. And we used to show on day one of the intake for the induction course. So they'd literally been with the company for like 3 days and then they'd whisked off to a hotel and they'd meet me or a few others. And we always had to show a video by an American who I can't remember whose name he is, what it is. But it was filmed from the 70s. So you can imagine big lapels, big collars and everything else. And he'd use this word introspection. And he would say, before I ever took anybody on, I'd send him away for a weekend with a yellow pad and I'd tell him to go on top of the mountain and write down everything and look at everything as to what they want to do and then come back and look at it together. And do you know what? I think you're the first person in all my years since then that I don't know whether you had a yellow pad, but that's what you did.
There you go. Who knew?
Fantastic. So you decide then to go to law. I take it that isn't just an easy thing to do. So what did you have to do?
So I had to, I'm a very blessed person of my generation because my first degree was fully funded by the state in the old days. You didn't to have, you know, student loans. The tuition was covered. I even had a bit of a grant to pay for my living costs. I think, you know, you even saved then. It is not as hard as it is today. But then to go into change from obviously sciences into law, I came home to Stoke-on-Trent and I lived with my mum, and I worked as a teacher in local schools to earn the money to then go off to do the law course, which I did. And the plan was I was passing through Stoke-on-Trent, just, you know, for a couple of years, and then I'd be off somewhere very exciting doing something else. But when I left Antigua, and I came out onto it's a small airport at St John's, came out onto the runway to board the plane. The plane was actually called the City of Stoke-on-Trent.
No.
Yes. And I didn't know that planes had names. And I certainly didn't think any plane would be named the City of Stoke-on-Trent. But it's so interesting that, you know, that was 30 years ago. And here I am 30 years later working in Stoke-on-Trent.
The plane had been called the City of Hawaii or something like that.
Exactly. Honolulu. Yes, exactly.
So I tell you, I think we better fast forward now because you've got a lot. I know that people have been listening today regarding the situation of mental health. Obviously, you then started to specialise at another firm. And why did you feel that it was important to get involved in mental health?
My late mother was a mental health social worker. My sister is a psychiatrist. And so awareness of mental health had always been, you know, in my life and in my experience. And I think as well, you know, as a Christian, you know, I had serious periods of depression. And so I understood how difficult life can be. And how important it is to have the right loving support around. And actually how vulnerable people are when they are mentally unwell. And so, you know, that I was working at a firm in Stoke-on-Trent, and I actually wrote to another firm who did mental health work and said, could I come and work for you and learn how to do this? Because it's something that I just feel called to do.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. I went to move firm. I trained and, you know, that's part now of the work that I do. It's not all the work that I do, but it's part of what I do. And I feel very privileged to do it.
Well, it's very good of you to say that you've had depression. For those that haven't really got an understanding of what depression is, how would you describe it?
Obviously, there are degrees, aren't there? And I think, you know, we all at times can feel low. Mm-hmm. We all at times can feel worthless and unloved and unworthy. And I know what that feels like. And it's a bad thing. I mean, when it becomes chronic, you know, even the simplest things are a mountain to climb. You know, it's not people being difficult. It's not people being sad. It's people, you know, unable to function, unable to do the things that they want to do, you know, to live the life that they want to do. And it's debilitating, and it's a great waste. A waste of people's talents and gifts. And then, of course, you know, there's people then will sometimes feel that they don't want to carry on, you know, and, you know, that's such a tragedy. Yeah. But, you know, I suppose I can understand the feeling that people feel sometimes when they feel that people are actually better off without them. And that's a really sad and terrible thing to feel, but I can understand that. But obviously that the message is to, if you do feel like that, to reach out, to speak to anybody. There are many charities for young people and for older people, the Samaritans, Young Minds, who will offer someone to listen. And I think the people that you see who've perhaps been in that place and step back and gone on to find meaning and actual joy in their lives.
Yeah.
You know, that's something to hold on to, because actually things change. Things do get better. It can take an awfully long time, but there is joy to be had, and you are worthy and you are loved. And, you know, you are a precious child of God.
Yes.
And God doesn't make mistakes. When he made you, he didn't make a mistake. So that is,
great answer. I can see this going in two directions, the rest of the interview, if that's all right, Sri. So the first thing is, I think for people who might be at a certain age, like you and me, who were thinking, well, you know, we're coming up to retirement, you know, everything's okay, you know, I've got a nice family or whatever, and I've put some money aside for the pension. But you decide to forget all that and walk away from your job and start up a new company when many others would be saying, no, I'm going to enjoy this now. So why did you do it?
I mean, if I'm very honest, which I want to be, I think it's a mixture of reasons. I think being a woman and a mom and working, it's difficult because you feel there are things that you would like to do in your working life. Mm. But you also want to be there for your family. And so really, and also coming into the law as a second career, to be honest, when I got to my 50s, I felt like I'm only just getting going. So, you know, there is that element. Yeah, yeah. The second thing is that the work that I am privileged to take part in is, I think, is really important work. And I think it's... there are many different ways of doing it. And I wanted to deliver the work that we do in a way that puts the client first and centre, and also puts the people we work with first and centre. So our little saying is, you know, we're here to look after the clients and look after each other. And if we get that right, hopefully many other things will fall into place. So the idea, although it seemed absolutely impossible and terrifying at the time, it suddenly became achievable. And I think that's something else that I've learned, that there's a saying, isn't it? And the saying goes something like, God doesn't call the equipped. God calls you and then he equips you. So if you feel that you are in God's will, doing something that you feel he's called you to do, then he will enable. Doesn't mean it's going to be easy. Doesn't mean it won't be hours and hours of work, maybe some difficulties along the way. But if it's what he wants you to do, you just get on with it and he will give you the resources. So actually, I'm 56. I was going to say I was 57 then. I'm not. I'm 59, actually. 59 now. And I suppose, God willing, while I've got strength, while I've got my health, which is obviously not a given, it'd be good to carry on. And I work with the most amazing group of people who look after each other and who look after the people that we care for, we support, who are in vulnerable circumstances. So that's why we really just wanted to do things a particular way. Had the opportunity, why not?
And you did, and you have.
And did.
The result of which, you've won at least two major awards. And I wasn't aware of this until doing a little bit of research, that... within the Law Society, in-house, whatever, they actually still give awards. And you've won two, which one was from, was it not the Law Society, Legal Aid, if I remember rightly?
Yeah, I was such a shock.
Yeah, tell us more about that.
Yeah, that was the Legal Aid Mental Capacity Practitioner of the Year.
Yeah.
I mean, I seriously felt unworthy of that. But I think it was perhaps... in part due to some work that I'd done on a new mental capacity piece of legislation that was coming in and was drafted in such a way that didn't deliver the best for people who don't have all the understanding. So we worked really hard with the government agencies to get a far better piece of legislation out of that. So I kind of think that there was something left behind it. But I mean, truly, I mean, yeah, there are some fantastic legal aid practitioners out there. To be within their company was incredibly humbling.
Wow, fantastic. So you've now got this company going. Give us a plug. What's it called?
Bless you. It's called Green Church Legal, and we're in Stoke-on-Trent, but we are quite niche. So, yes. You know, we don't do conveyancing or personal injury, you know. So we do the mental health, as I've said.
Or podcasts that are going to be sued for whatever reason. You don't do that either.
Yes, exactly. No, we definitely don't do that. So we represent people who are detained under the Mental Health Act. And
right,
we also,
can I just stop you there? Detained under the Mental Health Act. Tell me more.
Yeah. Okay. So people are more familiar with the term being sectioned.
Yeah.
So if somebody is mentally unwell and people think, or the professionals think, that actually they're so unwell that they may either be putting themselves, their own health at risk, mm-hmm. or their own safety at risk, or more rarely, and I would say more rarely, others at risk, then on the basis of two doctors' recommendations, two specialist doctors and a specialist social worker, you can be detained in a hospital and given treatment without your consent.
Is that rare?
But because, well, sadly, in recent years, it's been escalating. Mm. More and more people are being detained.
Why?
Well, partly because community services have dwindled. So the less structured, the more casual, relaxed help just isn't available. Mm-hmm. So what happens now is that people become more and more ill, become acutely unwell before they get picked up by services. So, I mean, that is probably the main reason why it's been escalating. There just isn't the help that used to be there in the community. Maybe it's because we don't relate to each other in the same way. You know, people don't live in, you know, generational houses. More people live alone. I don't know. But it's escalating, yeah. And it's a massive problem. The government's recognised that too many people are being detained, sectioned. But because you can't just, you know, lock somebody up, which is what you're doing, yeah. Who, you know, committed no crime. Everybody has a right of appeal. Right. And it's one of the few areas of the law where you get somebody like me free of charge, whether you're, you know, you've got all the money in the world or you haven't got two pennies to rub together, you will still get somebody like me to represent you, to understand your case, to look at the evidence. Because, you know, people do get detained when they don't have a mental disorder. I mean, quite early in my career, I came across separately two women, both of whom were detained in hospital, both of whom had actually left their husbands. Mm-hmm. And the husbands were not happy about this. And so alerted services, said they were behaving out of character. They'd left their husband. You know? So, I mean, yeah. You know, the world is a complicated place. Many people do need treatment, but maybe they would be happy to have it at home, you know. So there's a lot of work you can do for somebody who is in that situation. Of course, they're maybe terrified, never been in a psychiatric hospital before.
Yeah.
And you can help them understand their rights and the process and just walk through it with them.
So, I don't know, Fred Bloggs, let's say, has been detained under the Mental Health Act for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Who would alert you to represent Fred?
So people have read their rights in a hospital. It's a bit like being in a police station, you know, or you read your rights. And one of the rights you're told is that you have the right to appeal and you have a right to free legal advice. And you're given a list of solicitors who provide, and you just pick somebody off the list, basically. The hospitals also, by law, have an independent advocate, an independent mental health advocate, mm-hmm. who anybody can ask to see, and they will help people as well to appeal or to get in touch with a solicitor, or sometimes friends and family find you, you know.
Yeah. And then it's your job to go and meet that person, no doubt, in the hospital itself.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you feel like when you go into a mental health hospital?
I mean, obviously, the first time you go, you're not sure what to expect. Every ward is different. There are wards where people are more acutely ill. There are wards where people are in rehabilitation, where they are learning skills to get back to their own lives, really. Yeah, yeah. At the end of the day, you know, you're surrounded by people who are poorly and, you know, It could be any of us. Yes. Anybody can have a bump on the head or something happen. I mean, sometimes, you know, physical infections or physical things lead to confusion, psychosis. It could happen to any of us. So, you know, you're just a person amongst other people having a really difficult time.
See, you and I are obviously of similar age, only I'm incredibly immature at my age. You know, one day I might grow up, I might not. But I do, looking back at my past life, realise that, you know, when I first started working as a 16-year-old, there was a chap in the office, you know, who said he was suffering from depression. And I was, wow, you know, thinking about, that's very brave that you're saying it, because those days, and maybe until recently, fairly recently, you know, if you said you were depressed, you know, you were thinking, oh, you're weird, you're being pushed aside. Has that changed, you think?
I don't think it's changed as much as it should. I mean, there are legal expectations on employers to make reasonable adjustments to, you know, to be aware of people's well-being. I mean, I'm working for myself now. I'm completely free. And in honesty, when I've worked for other employers, I haven't disclosed the fact. I mean, I've been very fortunate. I've never lost a day, really fortunate, never lost a day of work through mental ill health. Mm-hmm. But I never disclosed it to my employers, because I think that, sadly, there is an element of the world that sees mental ill health as weakness.
Yes.
And I think that's wholly wrong. But I suppose I chose when or where, you know, I would disclose that. And I was in a good position of not having to disclose it, because it didn't make any difference.
Yes, yes.
To my working life. I say with great fortune. I think it's a sad thing that people feel that they can't share.
Although this, if we could put a positive spin on it, if that's okay. My wife and I knew somebody who had been sectioned in a mental health hospital, and we went to see this young lady, and she was eventually allowed out. Mm. And then when we called in to see her again, you know, the staff was saying, yeah, she's in there, you know, we were made really welcome. And I got the feeling that, you know, things are changing now, that and for those listening at the moment who might want to contact you later because of what's going on themselves, you know, it's not such a bad place now, I wouldn't have thought, in hospitals.
Not at all. Not at all. I think, as I said when I was talking about my law, you know, there are some hospitals that are not geared to meet the needs of the people that are there, as I describe people with autism and learning disability. But I have been on some hospital wards with the most tremendous caring staff.
Yes.
Where the place it's a therapeutic place to be.
Yes.
Where, you know, people are kind, people are for the patients, people want people to get better. They see people as your friend. They see people get better and go back with their lives. So, you know, it must feel like the end of the world, I imagine, to be detained under the mental health for many people. But it is not the end of the world.
Yes.
And many people recover. It may be that they've got a lifelong mental health problem, but they learn to manage it. They have treatment which enables them to go about their lives, live their best lives, you know.
Yes.
So anybody who is feeling that they have an issue, I would say don't ever be afraid to ask for help. Because, there are caring doctors, psychiatrists, nurses, occupational therapists, care staff who are dedicated to supporting people through recovery.
And what do you, obviously, you find the job incredibly rewarding, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it now. So it's a two-part question. What do you personally get out of the job? And what is normally the overriding number one task you have to do for all your patients?
So what I do get out of it and what I don't get out of it are interesting, because I say we go to a tribunal which tests the legality of the section, and the discharge rate from a tribunal is really, really low.
Okay.
I mean, 1%, 10%, 12%, 1 in 10, you know, may get discharged. So I represent many, many people who are not discharged.
Mm-hmm.
I'm there to represent them at the tribunal. That's my job. But I found there's so much more that you can do for people, because, you know, when you're detained in hospital, you're vulnerable, you've seemingly lost everything. To even appeal to a tribunal is to take some responsibility for yourself. You know, it's to do something for yourself. Reports are written about you and about your health problems, and to look at those and to say, well, yes, okay, but okay, we can't get this person discharged, but they've not been out of the ward yet. You know, we can argue that they should be having some leave to build up to going home.
Yes.
So there are things that you can do to support people to move forward, even if you can't get and mostly don't get the outcome that they want.
And the negative side of the job?
Say again, sorry?
The negative side of the job?
Well, the negative side is that you don't get people discharged.
Yeah.
And that is, if you like, the purpose. I suppose it's like being a criminal lawyer and all your clients go to prison, you know? But you can sit down with people and you can be one human sitting with another human and explaining the process to them, talking them through the journey, being with them through the journey, explaining it step by step, so that they're not alone. They know that even if the chances are low, they've got somebody on their side listening to them and trying to help them achieve the outcome they basically want.
And what does that say, do you think, about your faith?
Well, I think it's interesting, isn't it? When I think about it, it's mental health is in some ways like the Christian life. You know, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Mm.
And, you know, we have ups and downs in the Christian life, and people have ups and downs with their health. They have fantastic days when you absolutely have to stop and smell the roses.
Yeah.
Because life is difficult.
Yeah.
And I think in the Christian walk, you know, there are challenges, aren't there? There are really dark times and there are joyous times. And I think as long as we keep going, you know, as a pilgrim, one foot in front of the other, learning through the painful times and rejoicing in our Saviour in the good times, you know,
yeah.
And keeping on, that's what it's about. Because ultimately for us as Christians, obviously, we have heaven around the corner and you know, all these sorrows will be gone and forgotten,
yeah.
You know, completely forgotten in the joyousness that awaits. But many joys along the way.
Yes. For those that are listening today and are thinking, do you know what? I'm either going to be sectioned myself or, you know, a relation is about to be sectioned. What would you say to them?
I would say to engage in the process, to be involved. You know, if you are, talk to the people who have come to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the person who may be unwell, talk to them. You know, be open, be honest. Try if possible to work with them. You know, you may be angry, you may be frustrated, you know, that will go, you know, we're all human beings trying to do our best. For families, you know, stick by the person, do visit, do keep in touch. It's been difficult, obviously, through COVID, but it's less so now. You know, stay close, talk to people, engage with people, accept help. And if help does not seem to be forthcoming, ask for help. And if you don't get it, ask again and persist until that help is coming.
Wow. Well, we're running short of time. We've still got to do who your hero is. But before we do, one of the answers to your questions were if you were Prime Minister for the day, and may I just say, I think we should maybe make you actually Prime Minister for a week or two at least. because you seem to show plenty of empathy and understanding, no matter what political side of the football you kick. If Barbara Castle was listening today, she must probably go, "Preach it, sister. You know, I'm really glad I've fought the law to change it for you." If she hadn't changed it, how good do you think men would have been doing the job that you're doing?
Doing the job that I do?
Yeah.
Well, men do the job that I do. You know, the law is an equal opportunities employer. And I suppose we all bring ourselves, don't we, to the job that we do. And, you know, I do things the only way I know how. And other people will have other gifts. There'll be people who are much better advocates than I am. You know, in the heat of the debate in the tribunal, when they're arguing for their client, there'll be people who will be much clearer in their arguments than I will be. You know, so everybody's got to do, everybody brings themselves, don't they? And
I remember someone saying to me shortly after we moved over to Northern Ireland, my wife's home place, and this chap said, "Do you know what?" He said, "Martin, I've learned that the way God normally works is that he looks back at your life the past 20 years, and whatever's happened in those past 20 years can normally give you an understanding of what's going to happen in the future." And you were, I think, incredibly brave to say, you know, that you suffer from depression, and from that, you've been able to turn it around and use it as a positive thing. And this is where it's got you. Quick question for those that are in that area of life where they think, "Oh, I don't know what to do or what not to do. Should I do it? Shouldn't I do it?" Whatever it could be, what would you say to them?
Well, I think if you're a Christian, you're called, aren't you? We're called. And basically, we're called to roll our sleeves up and serve where God has put us, in whatever way that might be. And I think going about our lives, not being afraid, I think it helps when you turn 40, actually. You know, suddenly you care less about what people may think, and you are less afraid to look silly. Mm. I mean, they wouldn't have invented dad dancing, would they, if men over 40 weren't prepared to look silly? And
some men just don't do it, just saying.
Well, yeah, I am sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, as you get older, you become less worried about. And I think it's hard when you're young because you're afraid to fail, what people may say and all of that. But I think if you can carry on just fixing your eyes on Jesus, through the ups and the downs, you know, he will lead you to a place where you can serve him. And actually, at the end of the day, it's about serving him, isn't it? Not being anything in particular. Or people say, don't they, we're not, God doesn't love us, and he didn't call us because we're special. We're special because God loves us and has called us. So if you have a faith, then if you do fail, you know, you've only got the loving arms underneath to catch you, and you get up like Peter did when he sank in the waters, and then you just try again.
Yeah, well,
I don't know if that answers your question at all.
I think it does. I think I can add on to that as well. You know, when people say, "Oh, I failed." No, you only fail when you give up.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, you know, the words of Winston Churchill, which is attributed to him, you know, never, 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 never give up. Yeah. And that's it. So you've never failed. And a friend of mine who felt all doom and gloom because of what he was going through at the moment and was thinking giving up his job, I said, "No, you haven't failed." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "No, you haven't failed. Don't give up. You only fail when you give up." You know, and he certainly saw that. Fantastic, Sheree. Thank you ever so much for joining us today. And should anyone wish to contact you, I think the best thing to do maybe is to give them our email address and then we can forward it on. And that's OGC, which stands for Off Grid Christianity, OGC@accessradio.biz. And biz, for some bizarre, strange reason, is spelled B-I-Z. This has been a BCSC production. Thanks again, Sheree. Just leaves me now to say to you, if that's okay, in closing, you have 2 minutes in which to discuss who your Christian hero is. Obviously, it has to be dead so that we're not sued in court for libel or slander or whatever in weeks, years to come. And the person can't be from the Bible. So with 2 minutes to go, please start off by your name and off you go. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Martin. My name is Cherie Green, and my hero is a lady called Gladys Aylward. I'll tell you about Gladys. Gladys was born in 1902, one of three children in a working class family in London. And she didn't do well at school. She ended up as a housemaid, as you did then, in a house in London, in domestic service. And Gladys, a housemaid in domestic service, was called by God to go overseas to China as a missionary. So she applied to the China Inland Mission, the main missionary society then, and she was placed on a training course. But Gladys failed the training course. She couldn't pick up the language, and so China Inland Mission let her go. But Gladys was called by God to go to China. So she did the only thing that she could do was to go back into domestic service. That's the only work she knew. And she tried to save her money. She also worked as a rescue sister amongst what was called fallen women in the docks in Swansea at the time. But she saved penny by penny, not enough to get a boat to China, but a train. And she actually travelled through a war zone. She was captured by the Russians at war with the Chinese, managed to escape, and eventually found her way to China, where she ran a little hostelry offering refreshment and rest to travellers, telling them Bible stories. She adopted many, many children who were abandoned. And when the Japanese invaded, she led over 100 children over the mountains to safety. She was a Japanese wanted person. And this tiny little lady with little to no education changed the lives of many, many, many Chinese children and brought many to Christ because she was called. And because she was called, God then equipped her.
And they made a film about it as well.
Well, yeah, she didn't like the film, apparently. No.
Apparently. The film's called The Inn of the Sixth Happiness.
That's right.
And one of the big bugbears about the film is that, was it Ingrid Bergman?
Yes.
She was about 6 foot.
Willowy blonde. Yeah. And Gladys was 4'2" or something like that.
Yeah.
A tiny dark-haired lady. Yeah.
But like we've been, or you've been discussing throughout this programme, you know, look what happened. Look what God was able to do through her. Absolutely phenomenal. Cherie, thanks again for joining us. And I wish you every success with your company.
Thank you, Martin. And you with the podcast.
Thank you. Cheers. Cheerio.